In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Farmers are asking for an updated farm bill, and they're going to Washington to be heard. From SDPB, today is Monday, September 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, farmers' union representatives fly in this week to remind policymakers where their food comes from. We'll talk with South Dakota producers about the importance of a new farm bill. We'll explore the political challenges of mandatory country of origin labeling, requests for stronger disaster assistance guarantees, and the importance of being able to fix your own equipment. Plus, USDA Undersecretary Basil Gooden toured parts of South Dakota with State Rural Development Director Nikki Gronley. They have an update on infrastructure, including childcare, after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If a kid from rural South Dakota wants to stay in rural South Dakota or return to make a life after college, the path to hometown opportunity isn't always clear. USDA Undersecretary Dr. Basil Gooden knows this firsthand. Gooden recently toured portions of South Dakota to celebrate collaborations and to announce new investments, all with an eye toward reimagining rural life in 2024. Undersecretary Gooden and USDA Rural Development State Director Nikki Gronley sat down with me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
USDA Rural Development, of course, is a big structure across the United States. As state director, I answer to the Undersecretary of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Ag, and that is Basil Gooden. And Basil is a cattle rancher from Virginia and really loves working for rural people. Yeah. And part of that stems from a story I love to hear from him where he was 17 years old. His dad took him to college and said, look for places where there's opportunity. There's no opportunity in the rural spaces.
Wow.
And it really stuck with him.
Yeah. Welcome, Dr. Gooden. Thank you so much for being here, Undersecretary. Tell us a little bit about that moment for you and how it's really informed your career and your education.
Well, again, thank you so much for this opportunity to be with you. And I am just honored and delighted to be here in South Dakota. A part of my job, I get to travel across the country and really see rural America. So I may fly into metropolitan areas, but I really get to go out to rural areas to see where the tremendous work is being done and the projects, whether it's healthcare or whether it's housing, infrastructure, all of these things are vitally important. So as Nikki indicated, I am from the state of Virginia. We raise Black Angus beef cattle, and it's a tremendous, tremendous feeling just being in rural areas. And so as Nikki indicated, when my dad took me to college, he said, you know, hey, once you finish college, I mean, he told me this as he was leaving the college campus. He said, hey, you know, don't come back to the country. You go to where the opportunities are. And that really, really just sort of stung me because, you know, the gentleman who has taught me so much about, you know, rural living, whether it's hunting, fishing, you know, everything that you love about rural America, he's saying don't come back to rural America. And so that ignited a spark to say, hey, we're going to change that narrative. We're going to work day in and day out to make sure that parents are telling their kids to come back to rural America. And so that's, you know, the philosophy that I bring to rural development. And I'm just honored and delighted that I get to work with a great team across the country. I'm so proud of the team we have. And they do tremendous work in rural America.
It matters for the rest of America, too, in what ways? Like, it's such a personal story, what you just told. And so many of us as parents have had those conversations with our children, and as children have had those conversations with our parents, or parents who wanted us to stay in our rural communities, and we just said, there's nothing here for me. And there was a fracture in a family because of that shift to urban areas. Aside from that, which is no small thing, the nation needs a healthy rural America. Why?
Absolutely. We see so many assets in rural America. Rural America is overrepresented and proudly overrepresented in our military forces. So there's a strong connection to country in rural America. But also, again, I mean, so many great attributes and assets. A lot of times people think about rural America as where we are extracting something from, whether it's energy or, you know, again, coal, of course, electricity, but
we will send you your food.
Oh yeah, yeah. Exactly. So again, it's, you know, agriculture. I mean, so yeah. Again, you know, that's what makes a country strong. I mean, again, having a strong, sustainable supply of agriculture. So rural America actually adds so much to the essence and the strength of America. And so it's vitally important that we focus on that. I mean, making rural America the places where people want to come back to, but actually people to stay there, making sure that they have the educational opportunities, the health care that's needed. And that's, you know, one thing that we did and look at today. We looked at a mobile health clinic that actually gets to go out and deliver high-quality health care across the tribal communities. And so these things just make the essence of great living, and that's what we're all about in rural development.
Yeah, Nikki, you had a good day, I'm assuming, because you get to introduce the undersecretary to not only the landscape of South Dakota in the car, but the people of South Dakota in person. Tell us a little bit about what you did Thursday, August 29th. What were you up to?
So we started our day in Agency Village and visited with members of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Council. And that is where we first got to see the Asniope Health Mobile Clinic, which is a mobile clinic that was done through the American Rescue Plan Act, which we all kind of remember from COVID and that bipartisan effort to make sure that we're thinking about healthcare, not just in that moment, but in the future. Mm-hmm. And so that mobile health care clinic is one that we did here in South Dakota, a $70,000 grant to help them get that mobile clinic so they can serve the 9 districts of the Lake Traverse Reservation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those folks up there may be in a situation where they don't have a car. They can't get to a clinic. This allows them to go out and see their tribal members, get them the health care they need, and if it's not something they can deliver right there, make sure they get access to the resources and get them in touch with, you know, maybe it's diabetes prevention and sure. Getting them the resources they need. Then we went on to Clear Lake, South Dakota, and toured a daycare that was done with rural development dollars. And this was in coordination with Grow South Dakota, which is out of Sisseton, and then also ITC, which is the local telecom there in Clear Lake. So this was a partnership to help an employee buy the daycare center because those who owned it, their kids had gotten older, busier. They felt like they couldn't keep that business anymore. She knew that community needs daycare, and so her and her husband bought it, and they were able to do that with investments through this partnership.
We are having this conversation with a child care crisis in South Dakota, which I'm sure is very familiar to you and other states as well. But it is a pain point for us, the expense of it, the lack of existence of it, especially in small towns where there was a structure. Maybe it was the neighborhood lady who did daycare, and now the town has changed, and that's no longer a viable option. And we're talking about daycare as infrastructure in a way that is fairly new for a lot of us.
Absolutely.
Not new for you. Tell me a little bit about, is it a service? Is it a business? Is it an entrepreneurial opportunity? Or is it infrastructure?
Sure. I think all of the above, to be honest with you. Traveling across the country, I hear some of the issues and concerns from the communities. And I hear affordable housing. But the right there with affordable housing is high-quality daycare or just the daycare itself. Mm-hmm. And recognizing the importance of quality daycare, again, with the foundation of children and making sure that, one, children are surrounded with safe, supported environment, but it allows parents to fully engage in economic opportunities that may exist either elsewhere or in that community as well. Or, you know, if parents just want to do something and have some time for themselves, that's vitally important. And so because child care is so, so important, we are actually having a convening in Washington, D.C. To help address rural child care across the country. So it's a child care summit that we're having there in Washington, D.C., to really explore opportunities that we can expand outreach and the impact of the programs that we have in rural development to address these needs, because we recognize that it, you know, not only does it make a difference in the communities or the foundation in the development of children, but it's just great for the rural areas, but the country and the world at large. So vitally important. We can't overstate the importance of high-quality child care in the United States.
We live in a state where we don't always like to take help. We have political leadership that doesn't always want to take federal money. Talk about collaboration and leveraging federal resources in partnership with state or tribal resources or community resources, especially when there are political divides and it can be, you know, not politically popular to accept federal money or talk about that.
Sure. And thank you so much for touching on that issue. I think today was a great example of collaborations and partnerships that really yield such a tremendous impact in communities. Certainly working with Grow South Dakota. We've actually, rural development has been working with them for about 30 years now. We made a tremendous announcement of some additional funds that will actually go to the organization, because they leverage our funds and multiply them. And again, it's all about the impact. We can talk about the dollars and the numbers of projects, but what we are really, really concerned with is the impact that's being made in these communities. And so you're absolutely right. Working with some municipalities across the country, they are concerned. They don't want to acquire any debt or take on any debt. And really, it takes some time to work with them, to let them know that our programs really are conducive to helping them grow economically, and making sure that we are addressing a need that they do have in those communities. So it takes a little more time to develop that trust and understanding that, you know, sometimes you will have to take on debt, but we also have grants, you know, to try to offset some of the cost of the projects, whether it's an infrastructure project, water project, clean water across the country, vitally important. Mm-hmm. And so you're absolutely right, but I think it's incumbent on us to really help educate the utilization of our programs and how our programs can really make a difference in rural America.
Yeah. That is so much of what we have talked about in the past, Nikki, and people in a community responding to a problem, but responding in partnership with other organizations in the community and in government organizations. What's your pitch for people who are hearing us today and saying, you know, yeah, we're responding, but we could use the support? How do they find resources?
So reaching out to USDA Rural Development South Dakota, where, you know, we've got a website. They can reach out to us there. We'll get you in touch with the right program. Partners like Grow South Dakota and the economic development districts in South Dakota are great partners to us also. Often people are starting there. They're starting to do their strategy and then come forward to us. And so there's a multitude of ways that they can connect with us. So I would say going to our website is a great place to find information on our programs. They could start there and kind of look at what we have available. That also is a place where you're going to find the phone number, which is 605-352-1100. They can reach out to us there at our main number. We're going to get you in touch with whether it's our water programs, whether our community facility, our small business team, or we do housing for low and very low income folks too. So that's, yeah, there's a multitude of opportunities. And sometimes we might say, well, this program is potential for you. Let's dig into it further, you know?
I want to know what you saw, Undersecretary, in South Dakota particularly, but maybe as it relates to other rural areas. How are we recovering from the pandemic? What are some of the lingering challenges that you look back and you're like, yeah, that's the scar of this? And then maybe even some of the places where you're like, we're a little bit better because of how we responded to that crisis that is going to help us be stronger in the future. What does that bring up for you?
Sure. So so the mobile health clinic was so impactful, and that came directly out of the American Rescue Plan Act that this administration actually passed. And so we provided an emergency rural health care grant there. That's a direct result of what communities were going through during the pandemic. And to see how they utilized those funds to actually bring quality health services out into the community to better reach the communities. Because I think, you know, if there's one thing that the pandemic taught us is that remoteness does not have to mean that you don't have access to either services or employment, that there are ways that we can actually deliver services, whether it's through telemedicine or a mobile healthcare clinic. And so I just think it's tremendous. I mean, I've seen so much ingenuity across South Dakota because, again, they're figuring out how to do things. And so I think they are really recovering really well and addressing some of the needs that were really raised during the pandemic. And so the mobile health clinic, I think that speaks volumes. But I just can't, say enough about the daycare, because that's so vitally important and so critical to communities. And you just, it's a need across the United States. And to see that they're taking the lead here in South Dakota, that is tremendous. And it's through, as you indicated, partnerships that, you know, we can't do it all alone by ourselves at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I think federal government has a role. It has not only an opportunity, but an obligation to address these needs. But we have to have partners at the community level, whether it's the municipalities, elected officials, nonprofit organizations, or philanthropies. And I think together we can certainly continue to move the needle, and they're doing an outstanding job here in South Dakota. So I'm just so honored and proud to be a part of this and get to work with this great team and the great community that's doing this great work.
Yeah. The U.S. Surgeon General has a report, and I heard him say that 48% of parents, nearly half of American parents, say that most days they are completely overwhelmed by stress. 41% say most days they can't function because of stress. The impact of that long term, it's great to hear the responses and the great stories, but the urgency has to feel so real for you in your role.
Absolutely. Mental health issues, behavioral health issues in rural America often go underfunded and unaddressed. And we need to bring that to the forefront, because not only is there stress among the parents, because, again, I think your points are extremely well taken. Parenting is a stressful job. I mean, if you're doing it right, extremely stressful. But also the stress that farmers and ranchers endure when you have unstable markets, and we're working diligently in USDA to stabilize a lot of that, whether it's through the fertilization program or meat and poultry processing expansion program. So we're looking at how we can, again, improve rural livability, just address all the issues around rural America. And so certainly, the daycare is just tremendous, something that's like a jewel that I've seen in all my travels. And I've been through so many states, but what you're doing here in South Dakota is tremendous.
What did you see today that reminded you of home?
Oh, I did see several fields of cattle, and so that made me yearn for home. And I was just telling Nikki how different the landscape is here than it is in Virginia or throughout the South. It is beautiful here. You can see for as far as your eyes can see, and so it is just beautiful. The weather has been just tremendous. And so I really, really have enjoyed my visit here to South Dakota. Yeah. Tremendous. Cool.
Since 2021, we've done seven other daycare projects. We had this one today that we talked about. We have more to come. And the great thing is our programs are flexible. So when we see this crisis happening across South Dakota, and we can jump in and say, wait, we have a way we can help. We maybe can't solve it completely, but we have some tools that can help these communities, whether it is keeping a daycare there, whether it is repairing one that is existing, getting a daycare, a van, so they can get those kids to school and back. Mm-hmm. We have programs for that. And it's great to see that there are needs in South Dakota that we can quickly respond to, and we really love that.
Yeah, we're here for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to say, too, I just want to commend Nikki and her team here in South Dakota because, again, it's tremendous leadership, and leadership matters across the country. So, again, I just wanted to commend her and her team. They're doing an outstanding job for South Dakota and the United States. So thank you, Nikki.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Legislators have until September 30th to help the 2024 Farm Bill limp past the finish line. Now, in the past few months, U.S. Senator John Thune and Senator Mike Rounds have joined the show to talk about the likelihood of a new Farm Bill passing. Here is U.S. Senator Mike Rounds when he talked to us on July 24th.
Unfortunately, I can tell you that there's not a lot of movement on the Farm Bill, but let's get into it, and at least I can share with you what I do know about it.
All right. Let's talk about why there isn't a lot of movement, because the concern is it's because it's an election year and we're waiting, but that's maybe not the answer farmers want.
It's probably not the answer, but I think you probably hit on what is going on. You've got a couple of things all kind of coming together. First, you've got the House, controlled by Republicans, who have passed a bill that has about 75% of it going into nutrition. You have a Senate bill that has probably closer to about 80% of it going into nutrition. But you've also got a Senate bill which has, first of all, a committee chairman, Senator Stabenow, who this is her last year. She's retiring. So she'd really like to do a farm bill as part of her legacy. At the same time, Republicans are thinking that they may very well be able to get a better deal in terms of their interests, having to making improvements in some areas of the Farm Bill right now with regard to the commodities under the Farm Bill, the Title I stuff, as opposed to more of it going into Title IV, which is nutrition, or Title II, which is the conservation parts of the Farm Bill. You've got a disagreement, and it's a philosophical disagreement between Republicans and Democrats as to where the Farm Bill should have its emphasis this year. And you're talking about $1.5 trillion being proposed to be spent over the next 10 years. And so the real argument is probably spread over about $20 billion in the bill itself. Mm. And Republicans are saying, well, now these are the folks that are on the committee. Some of them are saying, well, we going to get a better deal for farmers if we wait until next year and do it under a different administration. And you've got Senator Stabenow, who would really like to get something done this year, but she wants to put some more money into the carbon-based conservation areas and into the nutrition parts of the program. So it's an honest philosophical discussion going on between the two parties. The question is there perhaps a chance after the election, so after we know what next year looks like, to actually have the two sides get together and say, let's find a compromise and get something out this year rather than next year. We also know that the Farm Bill is due to the extension that's currently in place will, expire on September 30th. So sometime, I believe, in September, before the 30th of September, there will be an agreement to either send this to the end of the year or into next year. And that'll be based on whether or not both sides think there's a chance of getting a compromise put together after the election, but before the beginning of the next year.
U.S. Senator John Thune agrees the Farm Bill won't likely pass this year. He attributed disagreements over the bill's funding to a source more than partisanship. Here is Thune looking ahead to what's next. This is when he talked to us in August.
I hope that eventually we can get there. If it doesn't happen now, next year, depending on who wins the majority in the Senate, if we have the majority, John Bozeman from Arkansas would be the chair. Amy Klobuchar from next door in Minnesota would be the ranking Democrat in that scenario. And I would be hopeful that we could get a multi-year reauthorization bill done, but we have to find some of those additional revenues. And, like I said, the disagreement right now really over is over the where to put the money within the bill. Historically, the disputes have been regional. You know, the South has rice and peanuts and cotton, and we have corn and wheat and soybeans, and you know, Michigan and California have specialty crops, fruits, and those sorts of things. And we've always been able to bridge that gap. So there have been differences between regions on how to prioritize among the commodities, and we've always worked in that because the theory's always been either we're all going to hang together, we're going to hang separately, and I think that's still true. And that's why the nutrition title has not been split off, notwithstanding pressure in the past to say, why don't we deal with the nutrition title separately? It's a different part. You know, it doesn't shouldn't be in this farm bill, but you probably would have a really hard time passing a farm bill without it, honestly, because it's what brings people from the coast to the bill.
South Dakota farmers and ranchers aren't enthusiastic about waiting for another farm bill extension. South Dakota Farmers Union flies representatives to Washington, D.C. to meet with USDA representatives, our congressional delegation, and people throughout Capitol Hill. It's a three-day visit. Before they got on the plane, we connected with three ranchers from across the state.
Orrin Lesmeister, myself and my wife Tracy, farm and ranch out here at Parade, South Dakota. That's about 10 miles east of Eagle Butte. We predominantly a fall calving cow-calf operation with some farm ground. Been here about 125 years now, family farm, and just enjoying the weather this fall.
David Reese, I'm a cow-calf operator here in eastern Lyman County with my wife and children. We run a operation. We also run some yearlings out on grass, too. So been here. I'm third generation. So been here quite a while. Not as long as Orrin, though.
Yeah, I'm Scott Kolosik. I live 15 miles southwest of Lexington Springs on the East River. And we're kind of in the rolling hills. We're predominantly cow-calf operation also. We have some farm ground, but I'm the fifth generation on the farm, and we've been here 120 years, so kind of in between them other two guys. Well, Farmers Union does a wonderful job of organizing this event. They fly in people from many states. I think last year the count was close to 400 producers are out there. And we fly in, everyone gets there Sunday afternoon, bright and early Monday morning, we have a meeting with USDA all morning, get some briefings, get to hear from the Secretary of Ag, other speakers, department heads. And then they kind of break us up into teams, and we spend Tuesday parading around Capitol Hill, knocking on doors and meeting with senators and representatives and give them our story about our operations and what we'd like to see changed out there and what we'd like to see them. And this year, you know, emphasis is going to be on what we want to see in the Farm Bill. So,
yeah. Orrin, you've done this before, I take it?
Correct, yes.
Tell me a little bit about the experience. Do you feel like it's you make real connections and that you're really heard?
Oh, absolutely. You know, being a former legislator now, I understand what the face-to-face conversations are like versus an email, a letter, a phone call, getting a note from somebody. When you can have that face-to-face interaction and have a conversation with them and get the questions and answers started, there's more and more information gets put forward. And by doing that, we can educate more of the legislators on what our needs are in our area, and not just here in you know, Scott talked about the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill as a whole needs to get done. We've had 1 year extension on it already. We're probably going to get another extension on it. But a lot of that data they're using and everything is outdated and needs to be updated to what's going on with current situation in farm and ranch country. So, yeah, I absolutely think the fly-in's absolutely important just because that face-to-face interaction and it's a personal touch that way that you put on instead of an email or a letter or a note or a phone call.
Orrin, give me an example of, because it's easy to fall back on, well, we'll just extend this one more year. Tell me more about data that is outdated and how that might impact farmers in South Dakota.
Well, just in the last couple of years, we've seen tremendous amount of variance in our pricing of the commodities. And, you know, when that fluctuates, whether you're under PLC or the ARC provisions in the Farm Bill through FSA and stuff, it really affects your price supports and where you're at. Insurance is the same way. Are they keeping up with the changes? You know, our inputs are way higher now. So that's just a very minimal example, but you can talk on the cattle side, LRP program. It needs to be updated and keep funding it. So, yeah, that's just a very small touch, and we haven't even brought up SNAP yet, which is 85% or more of the Farm Bill.
David, tell me a little bit about some of your priorities this year.
My priorities this year probably won't. I've been there a couple other times. Won't change. One of my priorities is M-Cool. I really think that they need to get that in there and put it into law and keep it there, you know, in the statutes. That mandatory country of origin labeling is what I'm talking about. And the other thing is, oh, I don't know. I like going up there to the fly-in because every year we bring a few new young people. And one of my priorities this year, I'm actually bringing my son and daughter-in-law, and I want to kind of show them around and open their eyes to what we've been doing up there.
Yeah.
I think that's always a good deal to bring in new faces for the legislators to meet and for the new faces to meet the legislators.
Let's talk about mandatory country of origin labeling. It seems like common sense to a lot of South Dakotans. Certainly, U.S. Senator Mike Rounds and U.S. Senator John Thune have said they think it's important. What's the holdup, David?
I wished I knew. It makes absolute sense to me that we should have it. I mean, everything else, every product that I've ever bought out of the store has a label on it. For some reason, they, you know, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but I'm guessing the Packers or whoever are fighting against it. They try and say it'll be, drive up costs on the product, but in truth, it really won't. They already know where the product comes from. That's a tough one to answer. I don't know why they don't implement it. They had it in there, and they said the World Court threw it out, which I can see the other countries not wanting us to label our product because of just the competition with imported meat. I'm sure Americans would buy American meat if they knew, you know, could differentiate. But I still think in our country we ought to be able to label our product, differentiate it from foreign products coming in.
Scott, what would you add to that?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I was thinking lots of thoughts running through my head on David's comments there. I read an article here not too long ago that one survey that was done of the American consumers coast to coast across the whole nation, 90% of the people responded that they wanted to know where the food came from. And so the American public wants to know where their beef is coming from. Then I also read an article that said and I won't name any names, but one of the largest beef packers in the nation spent $35 million last year lobbying Congress. So those two facts here kind of should open your eyes as to why it isn't happening, you know.
Yeah.
And that really frustrates me, that money is too much of a play in Washington. But like David said, we've been fighting on this for years, and that's my number one priority too, is M-Cool. And I can remember on what David said also about taking young producers out there. My wife and I'm 49 right now, and my wife and I went out there for our first time 10 years ago, 2014. And that's when we first got involved in Farmers Union. We weren't even members until like 2013, I believe. And that fly-in opens your eyes, and it really starts the fire burning in you about what can be done and what Farmers Union does for farmers. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience for young young couples and young producers to get out there and see how the wheels turn in Washington. And but after being out there for like the last 10 years, you start to feel a little frustration, because we've been ringing the same bell for 10 years now about country origin labeling, and nothing's happening yet. But it's an eye-opening experience, that's for sure. So,
anything else that you wanted to add about country of origin labeling and just the politics of it?
Well, it's pretty simple, like you said, to most South Dakotans and myself. It's a protecting your money issue. I'll just say the Packers don't want it, because I think they're going to get scared at how much people realize outside meat is blended into ours, and how much of our good quality meat is sold overseas, because they can get more money for it, send it overseas also. We've got one of the safest and most regulated meat industries or food industries in the world. And that's part of it. Some of this meat coming in, there's not a lot of law behind it, you know, with how sanitary is it and everything else. So I think that's one thing they're worried about. The other side of things is, yeah, the other countries took a run at M-Cool before and got it kicked out in the WTO for a reason. They want to be able to keep shipping their cheap meat in here, because, there again, we can sell our high-quality meat back out. So I think, you know, the Packers are trying to protect their turf and keep making their money. And that leads me into the last thing is Stockyards and Packers Act. Farmers Union last few years has been huge on that. We've been able to sit down with DOJ and stuff. So we're kind of coming out from two different directions, one with M-Cool and one with the Stockyards and Packers Act. And I think we've got their attention, let's say it that way.
Yeah. Oren, do you have the support that you need from South Dakota's congressional delegation for the Stockyards and Packers Act?
I do believe so. The only one that really did not commit to us last year, and I have not talked to him since then, was actually Representative Johnson. But he did not say no. He just didn't commit that he was on board with it. And he had some good questions, you know, how it was all going to play out. And that's logistics of it. You can't just go in and bust them up. Somebody's got to be able to operate them plants yet, or pick up regional plants, you know, to keep producing our meat. We can't just have that bottleneck all of a sudden. So, you know, but as far as Senator Thune and Rounds, they both said that, you know, between M-Cool and the Stockyards and Packers Act, yes, they were on board with it, yes.
Oren, didn't we learn a lot of lessons during the pandemic about supply chain and packers? Have we taken any of those lessons to heart that you have seen?
The only ones I see taken to heart is the ones that are in the industry itself. Mm-hmm. I do believe and that's something I like to do, is educate the urban legislators in D.C. that don't understand truthfully where their food comes, besides a Costco or Walmart or DoorDash or whatever. They've kind of fallen on the wayside with them again, that, well, stores are stocked full again, per se, and life is good. That's something we got to keep working on and make sure that's educated to them, that, no, this can happen again. This is why it happened, you know, with the big four, as they call them, controlling everything. This can happen again at any given time, and they can manipulate the markets at any given time. They've slowed the kill down just to backlog some beef and, you know, raise prices at the market level, supermarket, but kind of deplete prices at the sale barn. Mm. So they're still playing their game. They're still in control, and that's one of the biggest reasons why we got to keep working on this as a nation as a whole, not just South Dakota. We need everybody getting in on this and voicing their opinion and getting something done about it.
David, one of the things, it's a beautiful fall day in South Dakota right now, but we know winter is upon us, and we know how unpredictable weather can be. I think everybody can relate to severe weather events. Does the Farm Bill have adequate protections for farmers and producers?
I would say not. They've got good programs in place, but if we was to have a major regional disaster, a drought, or, you know, a huge blizzard that covered a multi-state area, you know, that would impact us. I don't think the Farm Bill's adequately funded to cover something of that nature. We get by right now because they come in and it's, all right, we can do this, or then there's this little thing here and we'll cover that. It's kind of an ad hoc program. Instead of having a policy in there where they can go in and have just blanket funding for, you know, some major disaster that we know eventually will come down the line. But the big thing is to get the Farm Bill funded.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Several South Dakota family farmers and ranchers are in the nation's capital this week. The South Dakota Farmers Union organized a three-day fly-in event to get these ag producers in front of lawmakers and policymakers for conversations about the Farm Bill. It's part of a nationwide farmers union effort. Now, members of South Dakota's congressional delegation have said repeatedly there isn't much hope for a Farm Bill to pass prior to the deadline at the end of this month. We're most likely looking at another extension. Part of the problem is election year politics. The Farm Bill is a massive omnibus package, and it includes forestry titles and nutrition titles. And historically, that has created bipartisan coalitions that move the Farm Bill imperfectly forward. David Reese ranches in eastern Lyman County. Scott Kolosik's operation is about 15 miles southwest of Wessington Springs. And Orrin Lesmeister is a rancher from Parade in Dewey County. Now, earlier you heard Lesmeister discussing how the various titles in the bill impact farmers and ranchers. He says that nutrition title also impacts farmers across the state as well as communities.
But at the end of the day, farmers and ranchers got to realize that without the SNAP program, we would see depleted prices worse than what they are at times, because we do have the government buying up and purchasing a lot of food to go towards that SNAP program, whether it's direct costs with a EBT card or if they're actually giving out wholesale food products. But it's the you know, 60-year-old question, is it implemented right? Are people abusing it or whatever? That's for the regulatory people to figure out. Should we separate it from the actual Farm Bill, take it out? You know, it could hurt us as farmers and producers at the end of the day. It could help us. And, you know, so it's a double-edged sword. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer that I can give you on it.
Yeah. Scott, what would you add to how South Dakotans can think about the Farm Bill and the partnership, the bipartisan efforts that happen, especially regarding the nutrition program?
Well, I'm definitely no expert on the nutrition program, but like Orrin said, it has to stay in there and stay part of it, because if you don't have that as part of the Farm Bill, all the representation from the coasts, you know, in Senate and the House, they won't have very little interest in what goes into the Farm Bill if it was just a standalone deal. So we need to keep that in to keep the population, the urban senators and representatives involved in the process. I wanted to go back to that question you asked Dave about the Farm Bill having enough protection for natural disasters. One thing I worry about as a natural disaster, it would also be like disease outbreaks. And I'm a strong opponent. I'm very much against mandatory or animal traceability, like the USDA is trying to get us to use all these RFID tags so that they know exactly where all of our cattle are at certain times. And as an independent rancher, I think that's an overreach. But there's ag organizations out there like NCBA and other ones that are in favor of that, and they're using the excuse of disease outbreaks and traceability, and we can, you know, isolate that and keep our export markets open if we can isolate all these problems. Well, common sense would say quit importing meat from countries that have the diseases and protect more of the American product here and be more of a sovereign nation on our food production instead of importing cheap meat and exporting our other meat, which when they export our high value cuts all those countries that they're importing it in, or exporting it to, it's labeled as the American beef. So country of origin labeling is happening. It's just not happening in the United States. But I just wanted to emphasize that common sense would eliminate some of these problems if they'd quit importing beef from countries that are at risk of diseases, quit importing cheap meat, and start labeling stuff so the American consumer can know what their food is coming from.
Scott, is there one topic that you want to close with?
I get a little frustrated with some of how the process happens in Washington sometimes. You know, like I said earlier, 90% of the people want to know where their food comes from, and the people we put in Washington are put there to represent us and represent the voters, and I think they're influenced by outside forces a little too much. And you asked one of the other guys earlier about the South Dakota delegation. I really believe our two senators are trying to do the right thing. At times, I'm a little worried about Dusty Johnson. I know he's been tough to get on board with some of Farmers Union's ideals and our goals, and he's kind of our hurdle that we need to clear to get where we need to be out there, I think. But I think our two senators are doing a wonderful job. So.
David, what would you like to wrap up with?
Another issue that probably doesn't get enough airtime is the fairness to farmers, a right to repair our own equipment. These big tractor companies, or whatever you want to call them, equipment dealerships, have got an absolute monopoly on repair work. When I was a young guy working on the farm, you could fix anything with a pair of pliers and a crescent wrench. Now you got to have a laptop computer and software that I don't even begin to understand. The dealerships, they control all that, and it's frustrating. You know, I'll go buy a $150,000 to $200,000 tractor, and it'll be some little glitch. I can't touch it, and I can't take it to anybody local. There's nobody allowed to work on it except the people that I buy it from. And they set their own shop rates and their repair rates. And it gets expensive besides being frustrating. I think when you buy a piece of equipment, you should own that piece of equipment, and you should own the right to repair that piece of equipment.
Oren, anything that you would like to close with? One more topic that you think listeners should understand or have their ears open to?
People don't realize a lot of our data-driven world today, we're uploading a lot of this data as people are planting acres or harvesting acres, and we're finding out a lot of that data is getting sold off to, again, the big four, the ADMs of the world, the Cargills of the world, at a rate of they're getting real-time information. They can manipulate our markets that way because they know how many acres are being planted of corn, soybeans, wheat, whatever, instantly per day. Versus everybody else waiting for reports to come out. But my priority, and David and I have kind of teamed up doing this in D.C. In the past, is kind of finding them urban legislators. I'll never forget a couple years ago, a gal from downtown New Orleans that didn't even know there was a farm bill until they explained it to her and that the SNAP program was in it and stuff, and it opened her eyes. And then we had a really good meeting with her staff about it, and she was new, to her defense. That's the people we got to really educate on what this is all about.
South Dakotans David Reese, Oren Lesmeister, and Scott Kolosik. In Washington, D.C. this week as part of a Farmers Union fly-in. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On the next In the Moment, the highs and lows of teaching, a preview of esports tournaments coming to a high school near you. Plus, from new majors to growing numbers, we check in with a few college campuses across the state. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.